This is the Biblical Mind Podcast, produced by the Center for Hebraic Thought. Honest five-star reviews help others find this podcast. Visit the magazine at thebiblicalmind.org for articles and videos that explore the deep structures of Scripture.
So moral injury has arisen as a really big interest out of two different fields. One is particularly in America, thinking about wounded soldiers, inner wounded soldiers who come back with shame, guilt, grief, and the post-traumatic stress disorder treatment to do with fear and stress hasn't really picked up the distress and worked with that well. The other field is particularly relating to women who have experienced sexual abuse or other kinds of trauma, where there's a whole lot of shame and kind of loss of courage and confidence about the world because of the way that they've been treated. And so this new field of moral injury has arisen to try and help people who are in that experiencing those kinds of distress. And there are some different kind of aspects that have come up. One is if you're a soldier, maybe you've done something on the field that you really regret. Maybe somebody higher up caused you to do something that you weren't really happy with, or you yourself did something that was disappointing to you. Or you might be someone who's failed to prevent something. Some order came down and you didn't do something and then there was a disaster. You might be a victim, as I've already picked up. And another one is even just seeing or hearing about something painful. And this not only relates to real life, but also could be something you see like on TV or in a text. And we're starting to worry about it because of, in some Bible texts, the way that some issues in Bible texts, like, mass killings or some depictions of women, are very distressing to people. And so that's another area of moral injury where even the Bible, reading the Bible, could worry you because you think God is a God of love. But then when you read some texts, particularly in the Old Testament, then, you know, the distress of, oh, I didn't think God was like that. I'm not sure that I really want to have God in my life or even believe.
Yeah, and so there's that disjunct between what you thought the church and Jesus particularly, and you get this kind of soft Marcionism where you think the New Testament is God is all love. And so it's more the dissonance that's created between what you thought was going on and what's actually going on in the text. And I see that every semester with students when they actually get down and read the text. Of course, then I'm like, well, read the Gospels a little bit more closely as well, because there's some anger and violence going on as well in those texts by God, or at least promised. So I think most people, when they hear this and everything you described about moral injury, they'd say, yeah, this is a problem. And maybe they've known. I'm a combat veteran, and while I didn't do anything particularly that I'm ashamed of, I think for a lot of combat veterans, it's a lot of times what you didn't do. And so, you know, one particular tour, we were ordered that we just simply couldn't report human rights violations, that was just going to happen and you couldn't say anything about it. And for me, that was one of the most crippling, I guess moral injury is a good way. It's a decent enough word to describe that kind of crippling effect that it has on you. So I think most people will be wondering at this point, now what's your PhD in again? And why is an Old Testament scholar so interested in the question outside of, you know, the general, like, oh, could people hit hard text that might actually be troublesome for them? Why is it personally so interesting to you?
So I'll answer the first question first. PhD in the Psalms, in lament. So I came in kind of with an interest in suffering, I guess, with human realities. And, you know, in the Psalms, people say, you know, it goes from lament to praise, but there are these lament psalms at the end. Which is what I did my work on. Why is there lament at the end of the Psalter when it's everything's supposed to be fixed and we're just going off to glory? Why are we having these lament psalms? And my answer, of course, is that, you know, until Jesus comes back, we've got the dark that we're living in, which David was grappling with, you know, enemies all around, people trying to kill him, but he still trusted in God. And I just think that's such a fantastic message. And then in my college where I teach, they said, well, you need another string to your bow. So I said Jeremiah, because I'd been taught Jeremiah previously and just found it a fantastic book. And the thing that I love about Jeremiah is it's so dark. You know, it is so dark. You know, some people, I know someone who is a very, very serious Bible reader, an older lady, and apparently she reads the Bible every year all the way through. And she's very, very holy. Mm-hmm. But she said Jeremiah is really a struggle because, you know, there's so much, you know, pain and anguish in Jeremiah. So she faithfully reads it like everything else, but it's one of the ones, a teeth gritting.
Well, the irony of that is almost every Christian in America, I don't know if it works the same in Australia, if they can quote just a few passages from Scripture, it'll be Jeremiah 29, right? They'll know that one passage that shows up on a graduation card where I know the plans I have for you, right? So, yeah, it's interesting that most people have this very fond view of Jeremiah, and I'm like, oh, no, you have not read it closely enough. So we're going to pretend like it doesn't say anything about you personally that you love a book that's so dark and you love the Lament Psalms. Why do you think people... I mean, you can just free speculate here. Why do you think people, I found that people don't like those in general. I as well, I think I'm drawn to them for various reasons. I assume that are because of my biography, but I find a lot of people are very uncomfortable with them. And even if they're like theologically okay with these texts, they just don't like them. They're like, that's too dour. It's too pessimistic.
Yeah. I think one of the issues for me is that people are looking for like the answer. So a book that's got beautiful, like you feel bad and you want to read something that will make you feel better. Like we were talking just before the show together that people like the first bit of Jeremiah where God says, I formed you in the womb and I knew you and I chose you. And people are like, yay, that's really good news. And then you said, but then I tell them like, watch out for what's to come, which is, you know, that he's persecuted and threatened and imprisoned and everybody hates him and nobody listens to him. He's a prophet who never does a miracle. You know, it's not, and it's 40 years of like, how would it be if you're like appointed to be a pastor somewhere? And for 40 years, no one listens to you. Everybody tells you you're a liar and you don't understand God. And here's this much better thing I'm listening to on a podcast that's way better than your awful preaching. I mean, it's just horrible.
Wow, that's hitting too real right now.
but the thing that I love as I've done this moral injury kind of thinking is that Jeremiah gives us a scenario that's like the question. It's not. There are answers, and if we have time, I'll get to answers. But just the Jeremiah's situation, you know, like right now, most people around the world have been locked down if they're not currently. We're in a lockdown now in Australia, in Melbourne. But you guys in America, you know, you've had different restrictions and so on. Yeah. So Jeremiah was in a jail, right? He was kidnapped. He was hated. His family turned against him. There was a time where he didn't have enough to eat. You know, he was imprisoned. He was lonely. He couldn't get married. God said, don't get married. Don't go to parties, which we're having for a little time, you know, maybe 1 year or 2 years. Our lives are going to be a bit no parties. Whereas Jeremiah, he just got like no parties. Never didn't go. No weddings, right. No funerals, which is like, this is one of the griefs of lockdown, isn't it? That you can't get to your grandmother's 90th or, you know, uncle's funeral or something. But everyone else was going, but he wasn't allowed to go. So you kind of touch in to it's like a dark book where, you know, this is your life. You know, we don't have to nick out to see something lovely in the Bible to cheer us up. We think, in the Bible, people had the same gruesome life, and his life is much worse on the outside, at least, than mine. Here's someone real in the Bible who's a good guy who suffered through this stuff. You know, you could be God's favorite prophet who was chosen from the womb, and this is the life that you get. the other thing that particularly draws me to Jeremiah is the terrible leadership. You know, just the kind of things that can go wrong in your life when it's not your...
Say more about which... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Which leadership are you talking about?
Yeah.
Just to be clear?
So in Jeremiah, there's the kings, there's the prophets, there's the priests, there's the wise persons, the so-called wise persons. You know, and God is not happy with any of them. And you think, oh, well, you know, maybe they had a few bad things. But when you see some of the things they did, you know, like one of the kings, Jehoiakim, he was really like he ripped off the poor and, you know, just had people executed because he didn't like them, you know. And, you know, like Zedekiah, he was the king after Jehoiakim and he was really weak and his advisors just like ran his life. So, you know, Jeremiah goes to him and says, look, God's giving you a way out. And he says, oh, my advisors wouldn't like that. I'm afraid. Go away. And then, you know, this goes right up till the end of, you know, like Jerusalem, like falls, you know, like a day after he says like, oh, I'm scared about this. Mm-hmm. So he causes the deaths of, you know, hundreds, thousands. I don't know. It doesn't actually say how many people were killed, but, and his wives, Jeremiah says to him, God gave me, you know, a word for you. I saw, or, you know, I heard the words of from your wives, that the wives and would be led out to the Babylonians and your children will be killed, right? So you're a person, I don't want you to imagine this about your own family, some other person that we don't know anything about gets the offer, look, you could do this and save your whole country, or your whole country will go down the drain and your own wives or wife and your children will suffer. The women will be taken out to the soldiers and we can imagine what would happen to them, and the children will be killed, right? This is your moral dilemma. And you go, oh, I'm afraid of what other people will say. And you don't do anything to save them, right? Like we have been in situations where, you know, rules came down to us from above that we weren't comfortable with. You know, if we think about the historic genocides, maybe we, you know, have some pretty terrible things on our collective conscience. But you probably could think of something worse than Jeremiah's situation. But, you know, people stuck, or, you know, if you want to relate to Jeremiah's wives, that was something I was particularly thinking about with domestic violence, coercive control, sexual abuse, you know, family violence, things like that, that, you know, you could just be powerless in the face of someone who either was like evil, like Jehoiakim, or just so weak that they didn't protect you.
It seems to me that in your research, you have fostered an imagination, the kind of imagination that none of us want to have, but you almost need in order to properly want to seek justice or to see any way of reconciliation. And that is, you have to assume what is actually happening on the ground. There's almost this, when we think of historical background information, we often think of, you know, what did they eat? Where did they sleep? How did they build their houses? But there's also this, how did they go to war and what were the real on the ground consequences of war, and power struggles and people who were abusing power, which we're familiar with today as they were back then. So I wonder, as a biblical scholar, and a human being, is there a way in which, like, how do you appropriately foster that, I don't have any other word for it, negative imagination, horror imagination? I know you work near Scott Howerer, and he's written a little bit on horror and the need for horror in our imagination. But how do you think about the issue of that horrific imagination?
In moral injury work, one of the things people do is take these dark texts and kind of imaginatively kind of enter the text as the story of someone else at first, and then like usually people in moral injury work are feeling injured themselves, whether they're veterans or people who've been through abuse or whatever. So you put your own abuse or, you know, veteran experience to one side for a while, and just go in and think, okay, well, how would that have been to be Zedekiah when he was so scared of his advisors, you know, which could have been your boss as well, you know, like you're in this situation where you're terrified, it's going to be horrible consequences, but you you don't feel that you have a voice there. Or how would it be, you know, to be the wives, knowing that your husband was going to send you down the river, or the children? So these are very dark stories, but and I, you know, it's not for children, you know, if there are innocent children, there's not for them, but for real adults who've been through what externally might be recognized as something terrible, like a veteran situation, or maybe something very personal. It could be quite small to another person, but it's very huge to you, you know, sometime where, you know, you told someone a secret that you weren't supposed to tell, and then, you know, you, even though it wasn't very drastic, you were so ashamed that you violated that thing. So just working kind of deeply with what's actually there in the text, I think that's I think that's a very useful strategy. Yeah.
It seems also that it requires in some way, and I guess you could read stories of people who've experienced trauma, or, you know, because I can imagine some people would say, well, I've never actually been traumatized. But it might, and it might be the case that they actually believe, I can imagine some people saying, like, I don't even know anybody who's ever been sexually traumatized. And I'm like, I bet you know at least a few. But that they've never made space in their lives for those stories to be shared with them, right? And so in some ways, I think what I hear you saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the kind of life we live as disciples to Christ also means that we have to be the kind of people who can engage the real stories of real people today and then build that imagination and say, well, those kinds of things were going on then as well. I mean, it's like the agrarian subsistence metaphors and allusions. They just expected that you knew, like, what a threshing floor and why it was important, you know, what it is. So, yeah, I could imagine a lot of people not tracking because they simply have shut out that reality in their lives. Like the pastor who, you know, rails against abortion, not ever thinking for a second that there are women sitting there who've had abortions because they're good Christian women, et cetera. Is that right? Is it my hearing correctly?
I like what you're saying, because I think it's a kind of interchange. Like, I think I can see these things in the text because I've been working, you know, in these other areas of, you know, trauma and so on, you know, in my work. And then you think, oh, Jeremiah, you know, I actually had done a lot of trauma reading and trauma and moral injury work. And then I'm like, oh, look at Jeremiah. This is just like a playing field for these huge emotions and experiences. So it kind of goes backwards and forwards, I think, because then you think, oh, that's okay, actually, to recognize those things. Like, God wasn't afraid of them. He put them in the Bible. Jeremiah had to live through it. It's not because not that I typically now would think that I was an evil sinner, so it was all happening to me, but that for some people, they think, oh, I probably did something bad, so all this is happening to me. So it also gives you resources, I think. I think this is how the moral injury stuff is fed in the other way to me, to see what the text is doing and how that's such a resource for us. So the book of Jeremiah tells these terrible stories. So it's like the Psalms, except that it's more like, because it's a narrative, you know, you get the absolute nitty-gritty, he actually was in prison. Like, you don't think, oh, maybe he was just feeling alone. Yeah, you know, he's actually alone.
No, it's, and he sank down in the mud in the cistern.
Yeah, like real concrete. And exactly. And people, you know, put him in the stocks and laughed at him and, you know, plotted against him. We know they actually, you know, plotted against him. So it kind of gives a bit of reality sometimes. You don't just think, oh, well, I'm just overreacting. You know, this is really there. But then there's all these amazing resources in Jeremiah as well. Like there's the weeping God. You know, the God's tears in Jeremiah are one of the most striking things. You know, chapter 8, chapter 9 are an easy place to find them, but they're all, the first 14 chapters have a number of weeping moments for God. He's not just like out there smiting, you know, he's weeping. And then, you know, you've got the laments. And in the Psalms, you just get like David or whoever, you know, throwing their prayer up. But God answers back twice. You know, the early laments, Jeremiah says, oh, I'm terrified about this. And God says, don't panic, I'm on top of it, you know, or, you know, you know, whatever, so that you have this actual interchange, but that's a resource like lament. And, you know, you also have just like the unspeakable stuff that happens to Jeremiah, you know, that's a resource, yeah.
Yeah, and Jeremiah is quite a crotchety guy. He carries out the role fairly well. And so I think, and I'm saying that because I feel like if we can continue to imagine that when you're crotchety and you spew aspersions at people that God is not happy or whatever, then you can imagine that people would think that he was fine, right? Like he must be fine because he's still over there ranting. So I wonder how far this moral injury metaphor or analogy goes. So injury seems to include the fact that it can be healed. And so I wonder if healing with scarring is also part of the moral injury discourse. And if so, how does Jeremiah help us there, or the Psalms as well?
I think Jeremiah's own kind of moral injury moment, and there's lots of different views on this, is in chapter 15 when he says to God, it's often translated, surely you are to me as a deceitful brook. And I don't think that's the right translation. I think it's, will you be to me as a deceitful brook? But he's like, all right, you know, we're going to do this. You know, it's all going to go wrong and I'm going to be telling people and everyone's going to hate me. I sat alone. I was cool with that. But what if you're actually going to abandon me? You know, like I've gone out on this very thin ledge. You know, this is like a missionary experience, or the person who goes out to evangelize their neighbor or something, and they think, this is going to be so great. You think, oh, but what if God actually won't go with me? I mean, it's a Moses thing too, isn't it? And God comforts him there and repeats the call, which I think is so great at the end of 15. You know, he repeats his call word for word, all the best things from the call, I'll be with you and so on. So I think I originally thought Jeremiah was morally wounded by all this, you know, by his experience, but I think now he had a moment where he would go into the dark, you know, which is what happens to us, isn't it? We think, oh, God isn't what I thought, or he wasn't with me at that time, or my father or my boss or my commander or my, you know, whoever, they're not trustworthy. Like, how can I live in a world where there's no protection? I think that's the huge experience of moral injury, that life is just not safe and the people that should be trustworthy are not. So I think he kind of has a little turning point there where he feels that God, you know, is going to be trustworthy.
Hello, hello. My name is Ari Lam, and I'm the host of Good Faith Effort, the podcast where we show you how the values and ideas of the Bible can illuminate all the most important conversations in society. Conversations feel like they've become so predictable nowadays. You open up Twitter, turn on the news, or even just strike up a conversation with your friends, and you probably feel like you more or less know exactly what people are going to say before they even say it. So Good Faith Effort is all about having those conversations that you literally will not hear anywhere else. Want to hear the former head of publicity at Def Jam Records and a legend in the world of hip-hop talk about how Abraham in the book of Genesis helps him see Run DMC in a new light? Want to hear a leading VC in Silicon Valley talk about how the prophet Isaiah informs her work? Want to hear a reporter for the New York Times talk about why she's converting to Judaism, or a best-selling author and professor of the humanities talk about why she decided to convert to Catholicism? Want to hear an Oscar-winning producer and leading podcaster reflect on how religion can save the American soul? Well, all I can say is subscribe to Good Faith Effort on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get podcasts, and give us a listen. And listen in to the inspiring, fun, crazy conversations that you wouldn't hear anywhere else.
You just threw out the missionary journey, but I think there's something, you know, the reason why missionaries often missionaries that go into completely different cultures often have such extreme existential crises. And it's like almost clockwork. You know, when they train missionaries, they're like, okay, at about 18 months, expect to go through this wave of emotions. But I do wonder, as somebody who's lived in other cultures, like, is that necessary? You know, the one thing it does for you is it kind of removes every comfort zone, every, like, even your favorite foods you can't get a hold of. You know, like, nothing can ultimately bring you comfort culturally, all the culturally conditioned comforts. And now you just really do have to trust God, right? And you're thinking about it more than others. So I wonder if there's some way in which, just to put it politely, when we're talking about our moral injuries and that need to know that God is just with us, which, again, I love it that you're pointing, yeah, Moses, it's just like, I'll be with you. Wherever you go, I'll be with you. This is going to be crazy, but I'll be with you. I'm wondering, like, are there paths to get to that point that just have to happen that are always going to be isolating, you know, outside of the return of Jesus? Is there a way to do this outside of this kind of very predictable path of being isolated, feeling alone, and then longing for that sense of comfort? And then everybody I've known has eventually gotten it, but sometimes can take God takes his time, or he takes exactly as much time as he needs to, right? So
I guess that depends how much you've put your trust in the other or false things. So one of the big things in Jeremiah is in chapter 2, where God says, look, I am the spring of living water. And the other things that you trust in, they're empty cisterns that are broken and hold no water. And he's talking there, not actually, you know, the context isn't other gods, it's political systems that you might trust in. I'm not going well, I need a chocolate. I'm not going well, Netflix. I'm not going well, I'll ring up my friend, which is not necessarily bad to ring your friend or eat chocolate. I'm a big chocolate eater. I don't watch Netflix, but I'm a big chocolate eater. When you think, oh, God is stupid, I'll get chocolate, or God won't help me, I'll get Netflix, that's what gets stripped away in the missionary situation or the mental illness situation or the loss of the job situation or these moral injury type things where you return from a war and think, I'm not the person I thought I was because I was strong and trustworthy and true, and now I find that I'm broken and, you know, and I did stuff or I failed to prevent stuff that I now regret, so I can't live with myself. And then that's a kind of an opportunity then for God to say, living water, living water, living water. Whereas Jeremiah, I think, got on the bus pretty early. You know, he didn't go to the weddings or the funerals or the parties, and he didn't eat much chocolate, and, you know, he couldn't have Netflix. So I don't think it's inevitable for everybody, but when you get to that more sharp testing time, which I've been a missionary myself, that wasn't actually my darkest time. I had some other darker times, but sometimes to do with isolation. Though, when everything's stripped away, I guess, you know, death of a partner, there's lots of lose your job, you know, lots of ways without being a missionary, but it is very stark when you're a missionary. So the simple answer, I think, is if people follow Jesus really carefully from the day they were born, they probably don't have this big crisis, but most of us have other stuff. And part of our journey is to, for God to bring that lovingly to our attention, sometimes in a small way first, and then when we don't pick it up, it amplifies just because we go too far down the wrong track of where we're putting our trust.
As somebody who God has to turn the volume up to 11 every time for me, I feel that energy. And I'm loving this conversation because no matter what I ask you, you resource what you're going to say in Jeremiah, which, I mean, it's exactly the kind of thing that we want everybody to be doing, is to, like, be thinking alongside the prophets and with them and extend their thinking. I mean, Jeremiah doesn't say anything about moral injury, but he speaks loudly about it and often about the topic. And so it's wonderful to see your fluency and facility with the thinking of the prophet that you can just drop back in and say, oh, yeah, but here's where he actually is talking about this. I wonder in the church, I just interviewed last week poor Bishop Hooper, who has been translating all the Psalms into music, into American folk music. And one of the things they said that surprised them so much is how much lament is in the front half of the Psalms. And I was like, wait till you get to the back half. It picks up again. I wonder what you see as the role, thinking about the church gathered now, kind of how their liturgies and how they think about what they do and what they read and how they think together. Do you think there's a missing element in maybe it's just Australian churches, I know how it is in America, but there's a missing element of lament in our worship?
Yeah, we've been thinking about that for some years now, I think, in an incompetent kind of way, like, oh, we should have more lament. Right. You know, but so there are a couple of things that are kind of emerging for us. One is you have poor Bishop Hooper and we have Sons of Korah who do actually, it's a fun story. The guy who began the group, I think he was a Presbyterian for a while or as a baby or something, and they didn't use music, you know, like they no instruments, you know, because you got to be careful.
Right, right.
And mm-hmm. so he got really interested in the Psalms and trying to like think back into what the sounds would have been and so on. So they do like, it's very emotional, you know, their angry songs are angry and their sad songs are sad. Ooh. And it's just tremendous. Sons of Korah. Yeah, they're all over the internet. Yeah. You can watch them for nothing, as well as pay money, which would be good. So they're just splendid. So, you know, young people, it's like young people, lots of banging and crashing and, you know, good sounds. So that's one thing that's kind of, there's more available. And then another thing is people are rediscovering both liturgy here, like we're Anglican at our college. Mm. So people who are Baptists or something like, oh, the prayer book, oh, the Psalms, you know. And people are reading the Psalms secretly to themselves at home, like reading through the Psalms. So as your friends say at the beginning, you've got to wade through all those laments before you get anywhere cheerful. Actually, there's a lot of laments at the beginning, and book 4, which is 90 to 106, that's the one that's nearly all happy. But then the last book from 107 onwards, actually pretty well balanced between lament and praise. There's quite a lot of lament there. So that's, you know, it's a bit of a myth because you suddenly hit the happy bit and you think you're over the hump and then, you know, you have the new experience when you get to the end. But I think where we started this conversation, that people come to church or the Bible to be made to feel better, whereas part of what our faith is about is getting to the real. So Bonhoeffer says this beautiful thing about praying the Psalms. He says, maybe you're feeling good today, but maybe there's someone in Christ's body somewhere in the world, you know, some immigrant, some person in a massacre, some person dying of hunger, somewhere in Christ's body, there's someone who's suffering, so we can pray the Psalm for them, you know, with them, in community, with the body. Mm-hmm. And that's been very transformative to me. So sometimes we come like for our own personal fix, so we want something happy, but the laments actually take us both to other people's pain and to our own, which we perhaps want to put in a cupboard, whereas the book of Jeremiah and other places invite us to come as everything. But you have to have a safe place for that. That's another thing about moral injury is you don't just tell everyone the terrible things you did. You find a safe community of probably people with similar injuries and somebody who knows what they're doing, leading the conversation. So churches maybe have to be a little bit of a different shape. I mean, we could lament in a thin way that doesn't touch anybody, but to really go into the deep places, we perhaps have to keep working on really being there.
Well, Dr. Jill Firth, thank you so much for your wisdom and your guidance on this topic.
It's been great to talk to you, Drew. I'm looking forward to reading your new book.
You've been listening to the Biblical Mind podcast, exploring the deep structures of Christian scripture. For more, visit the magazine at thebiblicalmind.org. Subscribe to this podcast at all the usual places so you never miss an episode.